The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, we have four bills on our agenda for this morning. Representative Savick, would you move the minutes of House File of March 13th and 19th?
So moved.
Okay. The minutes have been moved. Are there any discussions about the minutes? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. So, did I say 13th? Not 14th. So, the 13th and the 19th. I think we have that. Okay. So, Representative Rosenthal, you are first. House File 1096.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1096 be recommended to pass and actually to be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill authorizes the Commissioner of Corrections to grant conditional release to nonviolent controlled substance offenders if the offenders have served a minimum portion of their sentences and complete substance abuse treatment. It had been passed into law in 2005 with a sunset in 2008. Then they extended it to 2009 and again to 2011, where it was not extended. The intent of this bill is to get people out of the criminal justice system, get them treatment, and reduce the need for our prisons to hold people that really don't have much criminal intent. And with that, I have a testifier, Daniel Guerrero, who's a criminal defense attorney, and he's going to speak a little bit more to the bill.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Honorable Committee. Dan Guerrero. I'm a lawyer in Minneapolis working with the law firm of Mesh, Brisher & Spence. I've been doing this for about 22 years. I'm here on behalf of the MACDL, Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I spent a long time on the board and was past president of the organization. And I'm here today to support House File 1096. I think it's a good bill. I liked it when it was a statute for the last several years, up until 2011. I was impressed with the numbers that I saw from the DOC study that said 42 people who went through this program, none of them reoffended or committed any new crimes. One was sent back on a parole violation, but there was no new crimes committed. And I think that speaks for the effectiveness of treatment and for people who want to go through this and successfully complete it. From a practical standpoint, I think it also encourages an early resolution of these drug cases in court. My clients, who sometimes are facing long prison sentences, they're not necessarily eager to plead guilty to these long-term offenses. But when they see an opportunity, albeit one that includes prison, to get some effective treatment, then they're more likely to resolve the case early, which certainly leads to less congestion within the court system. And of course, I was looking at these numbers. It costs $27,000 a year at Stillwater to keep somebody in prison. And by reducing these sentences and allowing them to be released early for nonviolent offenses, certainly saves money in that end. And, this morning I simply did a simple Google search on the positive effects of short periods of incarceration on recidivism. And I think people need to think about that. There's There's a host of scholarly research-backed articles and studies suggesting that short periods of incarceration, even probation in some of these cases, for nonviolent offenders was extremely effective against to guard against recidivism. And that's especially true for drug offenders, where they're given the opportunity for treatment. And so I think this bill is makes sense both for public safety reasons as well as cost effectiveness. You know, the longer people are removed from society, the weaker his or her social skills, their bonds, their interpersonal, their familiar, their workplace, their economic relationship to the economic world are tainted. And weaker social bonds there's more propensity to commit new crimes if their social bonds are weaker. And I think for those people who are nonviolent, who commit crimes based on addiction, there's redemption there, and they are redeemable. And I'm hopeful that this committee sees that. So not only on an economic base, but on a personal basis as well. I had a client who successfully completed this program. He was a father of three young children. And believe me, he was not happy to have to go to prison for the crimes he committed. But he successfully completed this program, and he was out early, and now is a productive member of our society and supportive of his three children. And I'd be happy to take any questions if you have one.
Thank you, Mr. Guerrero, for your testimony. Are there any questions of Mr. Guerrero? We need to get it. We have a couple of amendments to get it in the shape that the author would like. Let's do the amendments first. There's two amendments here. Is the 270, are both of these yours, or are they both Representative Kelly's?
Representative Kelly has the amendment that is going to go on the bill.
Okay. Well, are there any questions of Mr. Guerrero? Representative Kiefer?
Yeah. Thanks.
Oh, sorry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just based on the story you just said at the end, can you tell me a little bit more about the crime that sent the dad to prison? Just wondering if this was a victimless crime. Just give me an idea of not real detail, but just...
Mr. Guerrero.
It involved the sale of some cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
I can't specifically remember the amount, but I believe, you know, he pled as a possession offense, and sometimes that happens. I mean, you're going to get prosecutors that make offers to possession offenses that might start out as sale. And
so, Mr. Chair,
Representative Keith,
are you saying he sold it to someone?
There was allegations that he...
Mr. Guerrero, we have to sort of go through the chair here just so we get this on the tape, so that's okay. Please proceed. Please proceed.
There were allegations that he sold to some people. He pled to a possession offense.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So was it a more serious crime that he plea bargained down?
Mr. Guerrero.
I believe it was, yes.
And one more question,
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you. Can you give me an idea of just a general average age of the people that maybe this bill would help out, and do they have gainful employment afterwards too?
Mr. Guerrero.
In my experience, the average age is anywhere from 22 to 32. And as I said earlier, I think the longer they are in prison, the less likely they are to be employable after they get out. so this bill helps in that respect. Some clients have better opportunities than others to become employed either before or after they've been incarcerated.
Thank you.
We'll take more members' questions. Then I'd like the Department of Corrections to testify, and then we'll offer the Kelly Amendment, if that's okay. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I'm trying to see how this process works then. If someone's going to go through this conditional release, would they then face, like you would in a parole hearing, would you face a board to be granted this conditional release?
Mr. Guerrero, I don't know. Do you want to answer these questions, or do you want the department to answer them?
The department would probably be better suited to answer those.
Commissioner, questions. Why don't you come down and answer that question, please? Oh, I'm sorry. Who is? Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Corrections for the Facilities Division.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Can you answer that question?
Mr. Chair and Representative, if there would be a violation while on supervision, the department would proceed as we do with other people who are on supervision and make a determination of what the outcome would be for that offender, depending on the severity of the allegation that was made and the violation. And they may be returned to prison or they could be restructured.
Representative Neuberger.
I think I need to reiterate the question. Let's say the offender is in prison, and now they've hit that three-year mark, and they're about to qualify for this program. In order to be released from prison, would they have to go through a board hearing like you would for parole in order to be initially released?
Commissioner Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, they would be reviewed for their successful completion of the program, and our hearings and release unit would evaluate to make sure that they had met the statutory language for the program, and then their conditions of release would be established, and then they would be released.
Representative Neuberger.
So what I'm trying to get at here is I do like a lot of portions of this bill. There are some areas that I think that need to be tightened up. Where I'm struggling with this is drug crime. I don't see it as victimless, as nonviolent. Working in the emergency field for 25 years, I'm always the one that has to clean up the mess of people who've been on, who are addicted to drugs, whose lives are basically destroyed by their addictions. In the people that enable that by selling them whatever it is they're addicted to. Oftentimes, as was answered earlier, a lot of these cases get plea bargained down, and that in and of itself is a concession. So what I'm driving at here is I would like to see something where if there was a hearing where we hear, again, I'm coming back to this, I've stated this before in committee, but I'd like to hear from victims' families. You know, if there needs to be some input from the people that are on the other end of this. And I get where you're going. I understand what you're trying to do. I think trying to to help people become productive members of our society is a good thing. But there's always the other side of that equation that says, well, what about the mom and dad who had a daughter or a son that was addicted to methamphetamines, and it was a nonviolent crime, and this person was the one that was supplying it to him for years, and now their daughter or their son is dead. I think that there needs to be some victim input before we just arbitrarily release these people after 3 years. I do like this one strike and you're out provision that you have. On line 322, if you reoffend, you're right back in and you finish your initial sentence. I think that's really good, and I think that's commendable. But I think that it brings a little bit of balance back to the equation. But I think what we're doing is we're ignoring the effects of what they did that got them in prison in the first place. And there needs to be there needs to be input from families and from victims that were on the receiving end of these drug crimes. Then they need they at least need to have some input into what's going on here. And I think that that conduit needs to be made available to these families. Because I know that if my daughter, if she was an addict and someone was selling it to her, and you're trying to, anyone that's worked with addiction, you're trying to get these people off this merry-go-round, and they get caught into this lifestyle, and they do all these things to maintain their addictions. You know, they sell themselves, they sell their bodies, they steal, they do all these things just so they can continue in this addictive lifestyle, and that this person is making profit off. They could care less what happens to their customers. You know, so it's a nonviolent crime, but it's not victimless. And I think that that needs to be brought into this equation. Yes, I agree with what you're trying to do, but there needs to, you got to get me there. There's got to be some balance that's brought into this. And I think you're seeing that with the one strike and you're out, but there needs to be a little bit more for me to get behind this.
Representative Rosenthal.
Representative Neuberger, I understand your concern and agree with it. And actually, what the Kelly Amendment will do will simply say that people incarcerated for simple possession and will get rid of the dealers.
Okay. Maybe we would just want to, do you want to just have the amendment offered at this point so we can avoid, I mean, I... Commissioner, why is the program it expired, and why did it expired? Okay, then what?
Mr. Chair, the program was put into law and given a sunset date, and we developed the program, we screened offenders, and they participated in the program, but it wasn't renewed. It didn't impact many offenders in our system, and as we evaluate this new bill, we are seeing that probably 3 offenders per year will be eligible for the program, and we haven't evaluated it with this amendment that is going to be proposed, but it would be even fewer offenders, so there's not going to be a broad ramification for our agency as far as the number of offenders we're going to be.
Is that because program is, I mean, is that sort of the other program for drug offenders?
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. Our challenge incarceration program would definitely be an option for the offenders that would also be eligible for this program, and our work release programs. Both of those have an impact for bed days saved in prison, and our challenge incarceration program up at Willow River for the men, at Togo for the women, are full and have waiting lists, and certainly have good results as well from our research perspective.
But there are a small amount of offenders who could participate in this program if the legislature were to extend it.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay. Representative Kelly, would you like to introduce? Representative Lomer, do you want to speak now, or do you want to
wait?
Okay. Representative Kelly, do you want to offer the, is it 2 amendments you have?
Just one. But, Mr. Chair,
what are these amendments?
The A13 amendment is the one that I was going to offer. What's that? 266?
There's two amendments, the 270 amendment and the 266.
266, yes.
That's the amendment?
266, correct.
Okay. Do you want to tell us what the amendment does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, a lot of the discussion we're having revolves around this. As Representative Rosenthal said, we want to make sure that the bill pertains simply to those that have been committed a possession crime, and certainly nothing to do with sales. And so this clarifies that and ensures that's the intent. I believe this is a good bill, a good intent, and I'd offer this amendment.
Representative Kelly or Mr. Diebel, does this refer to all sales or?
Mr. Chair, I believe what it needed to do was it's added at third, fourth, and fifth degree, which it had not, currently does not do. Remove sales.
Period.
Right.
Mr. Diebel, is that, can you? If someone sold a small amount of anything, they would be prohibited from participating in the program.
Mr. Chair and members, the 5 degrees of controlled substance offenses are all partitioned into sale and possession offenses, subdivision 1 typically being the sale, and subdivision 2 is the possession. And so this bill would cover those who are sentenced for a possession offense under any of those levels of controlled substance offense.
Okay. Representative Kelly offers this amendment. Do I need to read it to you? It's page 1, line 16, after for the record. After 15203, insert subdivision 2, and after 152.024, insert subdivision 2, and after 152.025, insert subdivision 2. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Representative Lomer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would definitely support this amendment because my concern and what I was going to bring up was that we were protecting drug dealers, and this seems to take care of that problem. So.
Very good. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Does the bill do anything now, Representative Rosenthal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does less. The bill passed the Senate unanimously in its original form. This does limit it to just simple possession, which Representative Kelly and I agreed was a better way to go. And we just wanted to bring this issue to the forefront and talk about the need for treatment beds so we can start getting some of these people the help that they need.
Okay, good. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill as amended? All right, very well then. Representative Rosenthal will renew his motion. Is there any other discussion? Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, since you asked the question, I'm of Deputy Commissioner, I guess, the numbers. Is it a matter of we're just not finding these people, or are we choosing between programs? And if so, it seems that this should allow for a lot more participation. Am I missing something here?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is my understanding that we just don't have that many in our population that meet these stringent criteria. And with the amendment, there will be even fewer people who are eligible because they're not coming to prison for these types of offenses. They're being diverted to community supervision and other sanctions, maybe through drug court or those kinds of things. So does that answer your question?
It does. It says that, Mr. Chair, I think that we're probably doing a pretty decent job on the front end as well, and this will only help. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, could I just add one more thing?
Absolutely.
When the program was in existence before, our research staff evaluated the 2,500 offenders that were screened who may be eligible for the program, and all but 2 of the 49 offenders who were approved for the program were white. And so I think it's incumbent on us to talk about not wanting to set up something that would have a disparate impact on offenders who come into our system. So I wanted you to be aware of that. Certainly for our agency, treatment is a significant need. And we spoke to that when we did our overview for corrections, that 90% of our population has chemical abuse or chemical dependency in their histories and need treatment. 80% of our offenders are directed to treatment, and yet we only have resources to treat 30% of the offenders. So to open up that discussion about treatment for people in our system is very much appreciated, and I agree that there is a significant need, but it also is a funding issue for us.
Thank you, Commissioner. And that's a little segue that I wanted to announce to the committee also. I don't know if the email got, if you received it yet today, I will be sending out an email today. We have, after break, we have to get our budget agreed to this committee, and then it goes to Ways and Means. And so the memo I'm sending out is asking you all what you think your priorities are, because we have our targets, and we'll get those numbers out to you. And we have the governor's recommendations. These are his priorities. And you may share them, and you may not. And so, but I guess what I'm saying is, if you think that the Department of Corrections needs more treatment, whether it's sex offender treatment, substance abuse treatment, whatever it might be, this is our opportunity to craft our own bill. And so I hope that you look at the governor's recommendations and then think through, like, what our objectives are given the limited amount of money we have. I mean, obviously, we need to fund the core operations of our accounts, DPS and DOC, but, you know, you're going to hear requests from OJP programs, Better Women's programs. There's a lot of need out there, and I know that, you know, in this committee, at least on budget issues, we have not typically disagreed very much on funding priorities, but I need your input. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if I missed this, but what was our target number?
We'll send that out to you today.
Okay, thank you.
Send you all, and we'll send you the governor's recommendations, also to his supplemental recommendations, which gave us he's recommending a little bit more money. But that does not mean that we have to follow his recommendations. Very good. So, Commissioner, thank you. Mr. Guerrero, thank you. Does anyone in the audience want to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill? Representative Rosenthal renews his motion that House File 1096, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Finance Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Care of that. What did he do? Did he just There's another budget item for you to consider. Okay. So, Representative Earhart, House File 525. Before you get started, we'd like to again, Representative Simon would like, on behalf of the committee, would like to welcome the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. If you could all wave to us here. Thank you for coming. Okay, Representative Earhart. Okay, we lost a microphone there. Can you use the other one there? There's another one over there. Is there a way to fix the microphone that Representative Rosenthal broke? Okay, I think we're ready. Representative Earhart, do you want to move?
You.
Do you want to move? I will. The House will move. Where does this go?
Go to the floor, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Earhart moves House File 525 and moving to recommend that this bill pass and be referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill is regarding a current law would require a veteran who is on active duty would not allow him to take a reciprocity exam, meaning that current law says that if you want to take the Minnesota Peace Officers licensing exam, you must have successfully completed an approved degree program at an approved Minnesota post-secondary educational institution, or the law also says individuals who with more limited law enforcement education but with certain prior relevant policing experience in another state or in the military, and that's what we have today is Staff Sergeant Christopher Geiger, Air Force, may instead take the Minnesota Police Officer's License Reciprocity Exam. However, current law restricts from taking the reciprocity exam any person who is currently serving on active duty in the military service, even if the person happens to be otherwise fully qualified. This bill would repeal the restrictions by that restriction by allowing military personnel in active service to take the reciprocity exam, provided they otherwise have the prerequisite training and experience to qualify. And it's, nevertheless, it would continue to be the case that the person who passes the exam is not eligible to be a peace officer until being honorably discharged from the military. So we have with us this morning as testifiers Neil Melton, who is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officers Standards and Training Board, which is called the Post Board, for lack of not wanting to say the long term. And Mr. Melton, would you like to testify?
Mr. Melton, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Neil Melton. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Post Board. We have sent this language out to the board and staff members. Everybody is fully supportive of this. It will not have a fiscal impact on our agency, nor do we believe it's going to have an overwhelming work impact on the agency. What we're simply doing with this language is moving up the ability for a veteran, or in this case an active member, to take the peace officer exam. Then they're sort of frozen in time until we see the most recent copy of their DD-214 showing an honorable discharge, and then they are then authorized to go out and seek employment.
Very good. And does your other witness want to testify?
Well, we have with us Staff Sergeant Christopher Geiger, U.S. Air Force 934th Security Forces Squadron. He served on extended active duty until December 2009 and is currently serving on continued active duty with the Air Force Reserve until November 2014. He attended the American Military University in West Virginia and the Metropolitan State University in St. Paul. Experienced patrolman in Air Force, and he would like to speak on his behalf. So, Staff Sergeant Geiger, please proceed.
Mr. Geiger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. As stated, I've been in the Air Force now for 10-plus years. The last roughly 7.5 has been active duty, working here in Minneapolis. I'm currently a staff sergeant and certified as a patrol supervisor, which means I oversee the shift and patrol responses. I have a bachelor's degree in law enforcement leadership through Metropolitan State, and I'm currently working on a graduate certificate in emergency management through American Military University. How this affects myself and other members that are active duty is, as of right now, we have to get out of the military to even take the test. It'll allow with the uncertainty of job placement before leaving the military. It also affects personally because with the our proposal of our aircraft to be leaving the state of Minnesota, with that we'd lose about 60 jobs. And that allow us, all of us individuals that are qualified to test and have the option to stay in Minnesota. This doesn't affect me personally. I know at least 5 other personnel I work with that will benefit from this. And then also the countless members in the military that are active duty, military police that are serving nation and worldwide, to give them the option to come back to the state and bring their experience with them.
Very Very good. Questions for Mr. Geiger, Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Staff Sergeant Geiger, what is the standard enlistment contract for the people on your team?
Mr. Geiger.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now we're the average active duty person here in Minneapolis is on a 4-year contract. After that, we sign up for either 4 to 6 years. For active duty military, it's initially a 4 to 6 year contract as well.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Melton, what is the post-board definition of relative military experience in order to take the reciprocity exam?
Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, we have a matrix set up from all four branches of the military, specifically for military police, air police, Navy, and the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard, by the way. And we have a matrix set up of education within the military, the schools they've attended, the academies they've attended, and the number of years in that law enforcement capacity.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Melton. You didn't answer my question.
Mr. Do you want to rephrase it?
How many years does Staff Sergeant Geiger have to be in before he can take the exam?
Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lesh. Well, 3 years if he's got college, 5 years without, of relevant experience.
Okay.
Representative
thank you.
Lesh.
Mr. Chair, so why wouldn't we make, if the standard enlistment contract is 4 years, why would we make the exam that you got to have 5 years in? Why wouldn't we just make it 4 years?
Mr. Melton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, we did that language to parallel our interstate reciprocity with law enforcement officers from the other 49 states. If someone from Wisconsin wants to be a Minnesota peace officer, because we have higher standards, we required them to have 5 years of experience.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I appreciate the intent of the bill. I like it, but we're just hearing about a lot from now is a problem with our veterans that have a lower employment rate, higher unemployment rate than the general population now. And I would think that this would be one area that we could move in that direction. I don't understand why we can't make this modification. I understand that this might be tangentially related to your intent now. However, it goes directly to our efforts to make our veterans more employable. So I would hope that the post board would be amenable to that discussion in the future, especially as it affects our veterans. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, this is more of a comment. I've had 27 years in law enforcement. Minnesota is probably one of the elite states for law enforcement requirements. We have states coming from all over the country to recruit our college kids and the vocational kids to go and serve in their states. Representative Lesh, I think if it's a 4-year contract, these kids in the military, they're learning a lot there. I think it'd be amenable just to drop it to a 4-year for them if they don't have any college to go with it, because they've done a lot, and Minnesota is very, very highly respected in the law enforcement community across the country.
Representative Cornish.
Well, I can see where the two questions are coming from. The problem is that the law enforcement is just a little different than a lot of the professions. When you're talking about bringing veterans back in, this is specialized, and like you say, we are training to a lot higher standard than other states. And if we start, and they didn't used to be able to do this at all. And back a few years ago, they had no provisions for they started massaging this and getting more liberal with the requirements for veterans to allow them to come in. And so I think they've come a long way. And I think there's a reason for having it 5 years. And I'd just soon keep it that way. But that's just my opinion.
Very good. Any other questions? Do you have anything else you want to say, Mr. Melton? Mr. Geiger, thank you for your testimony and your service to the country. Representative Earhart, is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, I just hope you move the bill and we get it out of here.
Okay.
Thank you.
The chair will renew his motion to pass House File 525 to the General Register. Is there any discussion on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Mack, 404. Representative Mack, welcome to the committee. Representative Cornish will move House File 404 for possible inclusion in the to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Wait 1 second, Rep. That is the correct motion, then. So Representative Cornish has moved your bill. So if you'd like to introduce it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just a quick point of clarification, Mr. Chair. In conversations with Representative Huntley, which is where this was originally heard in Health Finance, I know the intent and goal is to get it for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Can it still be on route to go that direction? I'm assuming it can. I just want to clarify. I had been told that we'd just be going back to Health and Human Services Finance after Public Safety. And, Mr. Chair, I believe it's here because it affects corrections. Excuse me.
So Representative Max, staff is saying that you that they can include it in their omnibus bill if they want to make the appropriation out of their budget. It would not come out of the accounts of our budget here. So this is sort of, I guess, a hearing because of the corrections language in here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Go ahead, Representative Mack. Thank you. Members, House File 404 is a bill that aims at trying to enhance the policy discussion around what we fund and what we should and can expect to gain in return for the investment of taxpayer dollars. This bill aims to develop a nonpartisan methodology to show what the return is on our taxpayer dollars in the areas of health and human services and corrections. This bill would direct and fund a study for Minnesota Management and Budget to look at national models that have done this and come back with recommendations if this would be a good way forward for the state of Minnesota. Obviously, members, we're always dealing with finite resources and challenges around budgeting, and this bill basically helps us as decision makers and policy makers get a better understanding of how we're spending money and what taxpayers are getting for that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I want to introduce Kelly Harder, who is here representing MICA and MAXA, and also I have the benefit of him working in the great county of Dakota. So with that, Kelly Harder.
Mr. Harder, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much. My name is Kelly Harder, and I'm here on behalf of MICA and MAXA. In my day job, I'm a community services director in Dakota County, of which I have corrections, social services, veteran services, public health, even have the pleasure and honor of having 4-H and extension under my watch. It's a real honor to be here and speak with you. I will reference, I believe you have in your packet, two handouts, one that has an exhibit one that's duplicate on both sides. I'll be making reference to these, as well as key findings on a return on taxpayer analysis like this. As Representative Mack described, you know, you all are spend many hours with folks with great ideas up here and making their proposal on where you should invest your dollars that you have appropriated. And they're all usually really good ideas, but we do have those finite resources. And the question becomes, as I've made reference, how do we put that fifth column on the spreadsheet when it comes time to, in conference committee, decide where you're going to invest your money? And too often, I know on my spreadsheets, it's we know how much money we spend. We aren't necessarily seeing the business formulary on what are the outcomes that are factored. Was it impactful? Did it make a difference to the money we spend? And the concept that they have put together and run for years, for example, out in the state of Washington, through the Public Policy Institute out there, which is a nonpartisan academic institute, if you would. You know, this is done through the applied economics area. These aren't folks who necessarily are vested one way or the other. They're vested in making sure this black box they use that spits out dollars in and dollars out on return works and has good statistical validity to it. And what I would refer to you all as here is handout one, which has exhibit one on the front. And if you look at the page four, and I think appropriate for this committee, is this is just an example of what we are suggesting that MMB would go out. This is one example. There are others in the state. And to say, is this a good model? Could this be an enhanced model to improve the policy conversation that all of you have, that we have at the county level where we're investing tax dollars, and even at the city and other municipality levels? And what it does ultimately is, you can see, if you go left to right, this shows juvenile justice programs that have been deemed and had some academic rigor behind them to be deemed as a best practice. Then they run their rigor. Each one of these programs, I've seen the attachment of the financial methodology. You're looking at about 90-page mathematical formularies they run against these programs that ultimately come up with what are the benefit ratios, and it factors in total taxpayer, non-taxpayer dollars, etc. And it is that modeling that what I say, I grew up in Cottonwood County back in Mountain Lake, Minnesota, and my rigor is this. We run a complicated business. I should be able to explain to my dad and his coffee buddies whether or not his tax dollar made a difference or not. And part of this is actually changing the discussion and changing a way by which what we do is complicated in reality. But at the end of the day, can we show a taxpayer whether or not that investment mattered or not? So in Dakota County, for an example, I would refer to you as this, and actually go to this side here. We actually looked at our jail reentry program that we have started, and before we got too far down the road into this program, we actually looked at RAP program. We looked at the cost of the program. We looked at what risk it was mitigating. We then priced out the complete criminal justice system, the true cost that when someone's picked up by local law enforcement, booked in jail, county attorney, state law enforcement funded justice court system, county paid corrections. You go through the whole life cycle. You know what the problem with our system is? Everyone has a different checkbook. And it isn't as if the person who invests money in this checkbook gets the reward for that investment, because it's 13 checkbooks down. But what we did is put it all into a summary. Then we looked at what's the value to the community and showed in this example that over a three-year period, by having this program at a cost of $1.1 million, it shows a $340,000 return on investment. If you turn the page over, how this now starts to operationalize the emotion that you all have sit here and hear, is that counties at times, for example, would say, well, we're spending the money and the state's benefiting from it. Well, in this case, Dakota County spends $800,000. If you look at the very bottom net benefit line, and you go over, the state of Minnesota here has saved $700,000. Now, from a policy standpoint, it's tax dollars. Most people out there don't care whether the county paid, the state pays, who pays. It's money out of their pocket, and we want to show that this is a program that showed a good return on investment. It is just one small example that I believe if we had the capacity in our state that could do assessments against programs, we may have a more enlightened policy discussion at this table and other committees to see whether or not it's worth investing our finite resources. And finally, what it could give you is for those programs that come up here that don't reach the rigor of an appropriate return on investment, it doesn't mean it's not a good program. It doesn't mean it's not valued. It means we only have so much money, and we want to put it where we know the greatest return might exist. So with that, Mr. Chair, committee members, I We'll stop there and entertain any questions if there are.
Questions for Mr. Harder or for Representative Mack? Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Directed to Representative Mack. I think this is a wonderful program, a wonderful bit of analysis that we're going to be doing here. It's a great model. I think it should be expanded into other areas if it proves that we're going to get something here. It eliminates the black hole, as I sometimes refer to, with all these spending programs and things. Question, are you planning on expanding this elsewhere in terms of using this data?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eaglem.
Representative Mack.
At this point, if you're meeting down the road, I would certainly be open to that. I just looking at what other states have done and what it's been able, the information it's been able to provide their decision makers, I think it's a very promising prospect that that will be the case. I think the area of Health and Human Services and Corrections, as the bill currently spells out, is a great place to start. Health and Human Services, because it's such a huge part of the state budget, yep. With very emotionally charged decisions, and this would, and same with corrections. They're very emotional issues for folks and can be difficult decisions for policymakers. But that's why we've started there at this point. But certainly, if it's something that works, especially taking it out of the political realm by having it done at an education institution where you can have economists looking at these numbers, I think it will just give us good information and help us make better decisions and hopefully can expand it beyond these two realms.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eaglem.
Yes, I concur, and I think it's money well spent, and I think that this is going to be something that is going to be very beneficial to the state in the future. Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mack, when I went to law school, one of the first things that they teach is you can't prove a negative. And I look at this list you have here and key findings: total costs of arrests avoided, costs of arraignments avoided, pretrial detentions avoided. I'd be interested to see these other states of how you prove that something didn't happen by the actions that you took. Now, it appears to be legitimate, so I'm sure there's some way that you tried to extrapolate that, but how do you pull that off? Because we up here at the Capitol are consistently saying we're taking retrograde statistics and showing, well, look, my bill, when crime drops, that was due to my bill that I passed. So how do you pull this off?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh.
Representative Mack.
It's a great question. I'll maybe defer to Kelly Harder here, only because he's a little bit more familiar with how some of the other states have done this. And I'm not sure on the details of that. I think it's a great question. I do highlight the fact that with a lot of, for you know, each line item on this, there's that 90-page mathematical formulary that Mr. Harder spoke to. I can only imagine the complications that go into coming to some of these numbers, but maybe Mr. Harder can speak to that a little bit more based on what they do in Dakota County to help get some of those cost factors.
Mr. Harder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh. I'm assuming you're referencing on the Dakota County project itself, and in fact, what we did here was we had a control group of another county who was running the very same program. And what we were able, for this study in particular, we actually were able to extrapolate out a control group that didn't have the intervention, and we're able to compare and look at their arrest data and their information so we could do a one-to-one ratio analysis. What you bring out is very important, however, which is this does take a lot of rigor. And for me to come here and say, to do a recidivism assessment to say, look, we intervened and they didn't end up back in jail, well, that might be chance. We don't know that. And for me to say, because they didn't go into jail, now you should fund this program, it has to go further than that. We have to get true control groups, and we have to have the rigor scientifically for you to be able to have the confidence that it wasn't just a by chance avoidance of costs down the road, and now I should be able to show you it's a zero-sum game, so why wouldn't you fund it out of your budget? And because that question actually has been pushed back onto me often. That's also why, by the way, I appreciate the bill and the work they've done in the state of Washington for many years, is to be able to get down to the rigor so that question's answered.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that, Mr. Harder. And I did, unfortunately, take three semesters of statistics in undergrad, which was a horrible experience. For you ninth graders out there, if you never have to take statistics, please don't do it. I'm kidding. Get it? Yeah, it did come in handy. I just didn't like taking it at the time. So, you know, I do recall a correlation does not imply causation, and we're always trying to establish and prove causation around here. So you have that study. Are there other studies that were able to show the same control group impact in other states?
Representative Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh. We did a national comparison for this data itself. We stayed with a county that was in Minnesota because we could get access to their data and drill down to the depth we have to. There are other programs statewide around the nation who are doing reentry programs as well. Did we have the same exact methodology? No. But if I could also elaborate one step further, because of this study, we now sat down with Ramsey County and Hennepin County and our county, and we're building a at least minimally a metro-wide database where we can start looking at real data that's happening in Minnesota in the metro, so we have the real analytics to compare up against to that. So, yes, there are other programs. No, we didn't look and be able to drill down deep into their data outside the state of Minnesota.
Okay, well, just final comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I do appreciate the scientific rigor on this because I am always suspect. Everyone around here is trying to show that something they did yep. had the impact. But to the extent that there are other comparative studies too, those would be really worthwhile for me to see as this goes on. Thank you.
Any further? Oh, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question will be for Representative Mack. I think have you had conversations with the Department of Corrections about this bill?
Mac.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, I have not specifically. I don't know if Mr. Harder has. I've worked very closely directly with Mr. Harder on here, and he's worked a little bit beyond that, so he has possibly had those discussions, but I have not.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't see the commissioner here in the room, but does anybody have any information that would lead me to believe that the Department of Corrections has had some, at least, feedback on this particular bill in terms of impact and what it means to them?
Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. I have not spoken either with the Commissioner of Corrections nor Department of Human Services, and specifically the reason for that is being a state-supervised, county-run operation. In fact, back to this document, how we have used this is we're the ones funding this programming at the local level and at the county level. And I actually had my director of corrections, and we sat down with our staff. And we do two-thirds of these programs, which I'm proud of because they're best practices established around the country. But when you look at it, what I found out is we were disproportionately investing in programs that do not show a good return on investment. And we ourselves have adjusted our local budget into areas that have a greater impact for program and the money you invest in it. So I have no avoidance to speaking to those commissioners whatsoever, but it really is meant to have a methodology to move forward. Given most all the programs are delivered and operated at the local level, this is also where we see the value, making sure programs in human services and corrections are covered to start with so that we can have success and we can build off that success versus getting it too broad to implode on itself potentially starting out.
Representative Simonson?
I'm done, thanks.
Okay. Mr. Harder, thank you for your testimony. Representative Cornish will renew his motion. I don't know, really, Representative Mack, it could either go to back to Health and Human Services, it could go back to State Government Finance, it can't stay here, but where would you like it to go, and it can't go to the floor?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I guess at this point, just because I've had the conversation with Representative Huntley, for it to go back to Health and Human Services Finance.
Okay.
And if that needs fine. To be corrected, I'm
no,
okay with
that's
that.
Fine. That's fine. Representative Cornish renews his motion that House File 404 be passed and re-referred to the back to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any opposition to this bill? I don't think there would be. So all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Metza, you have a...
We have a deleto. Metza's here.
You going to move my bell for me, Ugla?
Welcome to our community.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
probably.
Looks like an easy bill.
I thought it looked kind of big.
It is big.
Chair will move. Where does it go? Chair will move House File 1095 for approval with the. To pass and refer to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So basically what I've got here, and I guess I would like to get your prerogative, this is my first time having a bill that is normally in a different department than one aspect of it getting covered here, and I'm assuming it was background checks that we wanted to talk about.
It's the BCA procedures that are in section 2. If you can, they're in the in section background checks in section 13. So either if you'd like to explain them, or if your testifier would like to explain.
Yeah, I can give kind of a nutshell for everyone. Basically, what it is, our registrars at the actual locations where we would get our licenses renewed, this would not apply to them. This would actually be a background check for the people physically making the licenses and then getting them back to our constituents across the state. So, you know, that's it in a nutshell, and I guess there's any more details that you'd like to go into.
Can you please state your name for the record and provide some testimony to the bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety. And these two provisions, as Representative Metza said, allow the allow DVS to be able to perform background checks on their employees in two areas within the driver services program area. One would be to implement the enhanced driver's license and enhanced ID card. That's a program that requires through federal law that any person that's issuing an EDL or an EID have a federal background check. The other part of the provision deals with our staff that perform tests for commercial driver's licenses. And the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration also requires all staff that are involved in the testing process or issuing process of a commercial driver's license have a federal background check. And so these provisions would allow for us to have just the staff that are involved in those two processes have the FBI background checks, and those would include people that are in the AFSCME union that work in driver and vehicle services, that in driver services area, as well as our middle management association members who are supervisors at our DVS exam stations. The department has met with the unions to explain this, and all employees were notified in November that this process would be required. We also talked with the union to explain to them that if there were any disqualified employees, that we would work to try to find a different position that they could move into unless there was a serious problem with the background check. But otherwise, all of our staff receive background checks, but not FBI background checks. And so this is a different process, and that's why we have to have it in the legislation, because that isn't a process we would normally require of our staff.
Very good. Are there questions of Ms. McCormick? Any other discussion? Anyone want to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill? Oh, is there someone from the Auto Dealers Association? No? Apparently not. Chair will move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wants. All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. What did the A2 amendment do, Representative Metza?
So basically, there were some concerns from the Auto Dealership Association, and we've worked with them on some of the scrapping procedures and just cleaned up some of the language to get it so it's better for their member agency or member partners around the state. So,
sir, did you want to testify about the bill or the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jacob Milner, and I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. I just wanted to say that we worked with the county attorneys and the department to get this amendment in a way that would work for everybody. So I just wanted to thank the author for working with us and the department, as well as the county attorneys, for making this agreement possible. So thank you.
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to give you a little background, this has to do with a purchase by a scrap metal dealer of an abandoned vehicle, and it only pertains to vehicles that are at a dealer for service or repairs. It doesn't pertain to late model or high-value vehicles. And so this would allow the required dealer name and address, and it also would still require the scrap metal dealer to notify the department within 10 days, and also includes the retention of 3 years for the records and requirements, so that we're all in compliance with our record retention. But it does take care of a situation where a dealer has an abandoned vehicle and they can't do anything with it. The person's left it there, they're not going to pay the bills. And so this would allow for them to be able to get it to the salvage location. So
very good. Thank you for your testimony. We have one question before you all leave, just so we're Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Metza, Representative Mahoney has a scrap metal dealer car crushing bill, so you might want to make sure that you guys keep talking so that your bills aren't inconsistent.
Yeah, thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative Metza.
Representative Hillstrom, we are in communication on that, so we will make sure that anything that needs to be clarified and worked out gets worked out.
Thank you.
Representative Metza moves that House File 1095 as amended be passed and referred to the General Register. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Members, we are meeting tomorrow morning, tomorrow evening, and keep your eyes open if we're meeting Friday. All bills and amendments for any action we take on Thursday evening will also be posted. Are there any questions before we adjourn for today? All right, very good. Thank you, members. We're adjourned.